Well, why don't you start with, before you have me talk about your first impression, well, to backtrack a little bit on your decision to come, two things. What was it that, about your teaching style or what was known about you that interested Peterson in you?
Okay.
And the other was, what sort of promises were made to you in terms of what the future offered, what your workload was going to be, what the kind of students were, what the success was.
Right.
So we sort of set the stage then in terms of what your first impression was.
First, again, I'm not able to say specifically as to what Peterson learned about me from some of these other faculty members. But I taught there for 2 years and had ratings, as we do today, by the department chairman and by students, and rated number one in the department, which might have been a part of it. Also, I was one of the newest faculty members in that department over many years. Because this was just after World War II. Most of them were people that were older. I was 28. I related to students that were, you know, my age, that type of thing. My teaching there was a difficult experience because it was a quarter system, and I taught 3 different courses each semester. Each was 5 units, so you met the class every day. And it's a time when I probably have never worked harder in my life than I did then. But I suppose part of it was teaching style, also able to identify with the needs of young men and women because of closeness in age, though I'm not so sure anymore because I think I still can do it even though there's an age differential. But I was given very high ratings by both the department chairman and also by the academic dean, who came into your class only by your invitation. And I felt I had nothing to be afraid of. So I invited the academic dean to come into my class and gave me a very high rating. Now, whether that's the kind of information Peterson received, I don't know. The story is out among many, and it may be fictitious, and yet some degree of authenticity, that after all, you did have a Scandinavian name. Now, in his talking to me, it's interesting. In fact, I look back now and I would probably ask myself, why didn't I ask more questions? But California, to me, was a dream. I'd been stationed here while in the service and had not been in Southern California to any great extent, but in the Bay Area, and really hoped that someday that's where I would live. And so it was a desire, one, to come to California. Secondly, to secure, as I think I probably mentioned last time, adequate housing for a wife and a young child. And thirdly, I had a kind of a pioneering spirit. I thought here was something unique. There would be nothing there. There would be new traditions that we could make that would hopefully become traditions. That we wouldn't be under the bondage of the past, even though I was an historian. I still didn't want to be under the bondage of the past. And that we could be, and I could be in on the launching of a new institution of higher education. He did indicate to me that he felt that the school would not ever be tremendously large. However, though we would be serving within the radius of our particular institution, because as we looked at California State College universities at that time, or just colleges, they were to be regional institutions serving those people. And within a radius of, say, 35 to 40 miles of our campus, we'd be serving as many people as lived in the state of Oregon at that time. Therefore, it would be largely a commuter institution and not residential, which somewhat startled me because I had been teaching on a residential campus. And during all my years here, I have missed that aspect because I do like a campus where the students are there and you're conscious of the education that's going on that's outside the classroom, in the dorms, and you're mixing with students more than one would be doing here. There were no promises made, nor were questions asked by me. What are the chances for promotion? I felt it wasn't a question to ask because it was a new school. Therefore, it looked as if the future would be bright. However, one thing he stipulated, among everything else, but among the few things he stipulated, I guess I should say, is that he didn't want me to spend much of my time on trivia, as far as research was concerned.
What do you think he meant by
that? By that, his feeling was that historians, or I mean not limited historians, professors, who spend a great deal of time doing research are neglecting their students, neglecting their teaching, and are not going to be effective in the classroom. Because his opinion was basically that which he gained at Stanford, where he got his PhD, that your promotions were based upon publications, it was publish or perish. So therefore he said, I will encourage research to an extent, but I don't want you to spend time in research that will take away from your effectiveness in the classroom. I have to admit, I've always enjoyed doing research, but I also enjoy tremendously working with people. And that's one reason why I guess I wanted to go into college university teaching, so I could be with the kind of people that I really enjoyed. And those words meant an awful lot to me, because I felt with the pressure of the program that he proposed that would be my teaching schedule when I got here, how could I do any research? So there was no pressure on in the sense of research. It was going to be effectiveness in the classroom. And he almost, well, I shouldn't say almost, he said, if I find you publishing a great deal, I'll have to conclude that you are probably not spending that much time on your classroom preparation.
Hmm.
Even though, you know, here I was immediately handed a schedule of four classes I was to teach when I arrived, some of which were not that fully related to my preparation. So I guess I didn't come with promises. I guess I came with dreams, I suppose one would say.
What were those?
My dreams were that first I was going to be in a new situation that I thought few people in higher education would ever have. It's always not necessarily easy, but you can always go to an old, established place. The rules have been made. The game is being played. But you don't know how to institute change. My dream was this wouldn't have to be a typical institution. There would probably be ways of forming, shaping curricula, probably doing new things, creative things, that probably other institutions might not have done. That was a part of the dream I had when I came. Later, perhaps, I'll explain that dream didn't fully materialize. But then there are other things that come that aren't always dreams, but the realities are great, too.
Well, when you said that you saw the chance for developing a whole new set of traditions, can you be concrete about what you saw in
all right.
those traditions?
As I look at it, I've seen institutions that consistently, that is with my experience as a student only, and then a part of one other institution where I taught for those 2 years, there were things that you did in the way of what I would call student-oriented activities. You always had a homecoming. You always had a spring renaissance there, and you had this and you had the other. And my feeling always was, why do we do it that way? Could there be something imaginative that could be done? Not that I had ideas at the moment, but I was hoping I could share with other people and in conversation and in working with students that might materialize. Now, one of my dreams was that it was to be a community, that it was a community made up of students and faculty on an equal level. I felt that where I was teaching, there was great distinctions, that there were lines of demarcation, that if you associated too much with students, are you really fulfilling your proper role? Can you evaluate those students the way you would like? I was sort of a rebel at heart, for example, at Northern Iowa, which was then Iowa State Teachers College. I felt that the students were being taken by the one bookstore in campus town. When they sold their books, they were sold back at a very, very low price. Therefore, with a group of students, most of whom were veterans, I became the advisor, and we organized our own competitive bookstore in a garage. Adjacent, contiguous to the campus. The president wasn't too happy, but I cleared everything with him to keep him informed of what I was doing. I said, this is not a profit-making thing. In fact, what was interesting, the group was made up of men who would have had to have been Boy Scouts in order to be a member of this organization. And it was they that came and asked if I wouldn't be the advisor. And we devised a very interesting buyback book, sell book, The over, all they had to do was pay 10 cents over what we had bought the book for. And then the 10 cents just became a part of little things that they, the group wanted to do in the way of helping children and others in the community. And this came to be very controversial. And of course I ran into some great difficulty with the campus bookstore, which was not owned by the university or the college. It was independently owned, but it was the one to whom faculty members, or to which faculty members, sent their book lists. Mm-hmm. We were trying also to get book lists and found that we could not get them. But students found out and then came to us. And it was that type of thing I was hoping we could even see here, which, you know, we do have something like that going now, but it took years to get that started on this campus. I tried it when I first came, and I ran into a concrete wall. You know, you don't do that, young man. But I got by with it. And it was things of that nature that I saw. I thought students were being taken. Mm-hmm. And why couldn't this be a community where we could meet at each other's the same level, that degrees or titles should be forgotten? And I think to this day, some of the finest people that I ever knew and who still contact me were in those first couple of years. I knew those students better by far than any student that I know today. We met because here was a common quad in that apartment complex. And as you descended down that staircase to the little canteen, you had a cup of coffee, you saw your students, they came to your home, you were invited to their homes, and it was a, I called it a leveling experience. Many of them older than I could learn a great deal from them. There were things hopefully I could teach them, but I felt it was a sharing and a very rich experience.
That's usually what you were looking for. Yes, when you...
Yes.
Did you, and you had some sense that Peterson was the kind of administrator, that that was an institution where that would happen then?
Not necessarily, other than the fact that he told me this. We're starting a new institution, and anything that's new can be fresh. He never explained to me fully his philosophy of administration, and I perhaps stupidly didn't ask. I guess because I was so thrilled with the thought of, one, coming to a new school, and secondly, that it was going to be in California, that I felt one man wouldn't be capable of doing that. Because as I understood the academic world, it was a participatory kind of experience, faculty working with administration, and together we arrived at where we wanted to go. So I was naive, in a way, by not asking those questions. Because even at Northern Iowa, I did see, you know, participation. So in a sense, my not having had enough experience in the field of higher education, and let's admit that when one is in a PhD program, you're not learning much about the government of a university. You're only learning your own discipline, which I think is one of the sad things that's lacking in a PhD program. Because you're trained to be a research person, and yet your work, your life is going to be in this kind of an environment. Therefore, I was writing many letters back to my mentor saying, you know, tell me more things you didn't tell me that I should have known. So I think I was, I'm an idealist. I have to admit that. I'm sort of an idealist. I'm a dreamer. I think things are possible. I believe that people can work things out if they're level-headed and understanding of each other. So I came with no fear or trepidation that this is going to be something uniquely different, that, or that there wouldn't be something that couldn't be changed. Mm-hmm. I felt change was the name. That's what I could live with.
Let's start then with your arrival here. You talked about driving down the coast,
yes,
with your family.
Right.
And arriving in Long Beach.
Yes. Yes.
You had not been in Southern California at all?
Yes, yes. I had been, one of my last assignments while I was in the Army was to take 3,600 Italian prisoners of war back to Italy from the harbor of Long Beach through the Panama Canal into Naples. So I had been in the area briefly, but as an officer in the Army, it was in and out very quickly. So I wasn't well acquainted. On our visit to California, and I call it a visit, we came by way of Northern California, visiting friends whom my wife and I had met while I was in the service, then on to San Jose, where Dr. Peterson was living and maintained his home, and invited there for dinner. And I was greatly impressed with his wife, Mary, and met his daughter. The two sons I didn't meet who were not home on the occasion. And Dr. Peterson, to put it in a very blunt fashion, was really sort of like an old shoe. He wasn't the kind of a man that put on airs. He didn't fit the stereotype of what I saw in my mind as a university or college president. I kind of enjoyed, I suppose, because of my own immigrant background. His father had been born in Denmark. My mother had been born in Sweden. A sort of a, though he was as old as my mother, yet I saw things in his upbringing that were very similar to mine. So from that enjoyable experience of being entertained in his home, we drove down the coast, coming to Long Beach on that September day, early in September, and September temperatures can be sometimes high, and looking for, quote, what was going to be a college. I missed it. The directions were given. It was obvious why I missed it. Ended up at Seal Beach, and all I got was a sulfur odor that only gave me one thing that so shaped my memory, was my experience in Florida when I was in the service, where I had showers that, you know, had the sulfur odor. And I said to my wife, oh, I feel as if I'm back in the Army. We found the site in Park Estates with just nothing but stacks of lumber. And I remember vividly my response to my wife was this: why did we leave? The reality of not seeing a campus suddenly hit me. Iowa State Teachers College, an old school founded before the Civil War, ivy-clad buildings. I knew I wasn't coming to that, but the reality of the situation, was such that it suddenly hit me, face on, no buildings, no library, nothing. And so we just simply got a motel, and it was on Pacific Coast Highway, the Virginia Motel it was called. It's now been removed, and I think it's a business section there. Found the people to be extremely friendly. They knew something that a new college was going to be located in the area, which thrilled me. I didn't think that would ever happen. Even gave me names of places where I could make purchases, because we sold all of our furniture and we needed quickly at least something in the way of bedroom furniture and a table and a few things. And the motel manager very kindly said, I'll call Carl's Furniture Store on Pacific Coast Highway and I'll see that you get some discount because you're going to be a member of the faculty of a new institution in Long Beach. That kind of reception was not what I expected to get in a great metropolis, because I remember my reception in Iowa at Cedar Falls, a small college town. Oh, so you're one of our new professors. I expected that in a small community, but never did I expect it here. But did get a little of it in that kind of an experience. President Peterson was very helpful and indicated that just in Park Estates, where the college would no doubt be located, there were new apartments being erected. And Mr. Whaley would do everything to help. He was the builder, developer, Lloyd Whaley. He would do everything to assist faculty in getting housing, which he did.
And this was an incredible shortage.
Oh, yes. And all those apartments in Park Estates were then being built. So we got a new apartment immediately. And my rent was $58.50 a month. And my salary was $4,200. And my take-home pay, I remember, was $289 a month. I have to admit, I couldn't save any money.
what was your reaction when you first saw the apartment where the classes were going to be held?
At first, you know, the image had to be broken. I had to get that out of my mind, that this is not going to be where we are going to be permanently. And when I saw and walked around there as to what they were going to do with those apartment houses, and sort of an L shape, and then a series of buildings that would be science and the art department and all, I got excited because I met new faculty, And they were as excited as I, and most of them, except for one, were all older than I by some 10, 15 years. And we became, as it were, in a collegial atmosphere immediately. And most of us, almost without exception, lived in the apartments in Park Estates.
And how many were there on the original faculty?
There were about, I say 12. There may have been 14, but somewhere between 12 and 14 faculty. And then, of course, Dr. Peterson is president. Dr. Brown is sort of the academic dean. And then Dave Bryant, who kind of crossed many fields. And Charlie Borkman is the librarian. And George Hackney is the business manager. And Fred Woods, who came from Long Beach City College and who's still here, he was the bookstore manager. So it was a small faculty. I might relate, because I think it's of interest, I had to work awfully hard because I was given 4 different preparations.
Were you the only one in history at that
point? Only, I crossed history and sociology. And I was not asked what I wanted to teach. I was told. And my first semester's schedule was recent United States history, and they consider that from 1900 up to then, a course in the history of the Pacific Ocean area, which I couldn't quite understand, because I'd never heard of such one, but Glenn Dunkey, the present chancellor, was then teaching at Oxley, Occidental College, and he had organized such a course, and Raymond Rydell at Oxley had done the same, and they had written a text, although it was not yet available. And Peterson was impressed. He liked the concept of a big view of history, not a small view of some segment of history, such as my specialty, like Civil War Reconstruction. That was an ideal course. I never had a course on the Far East. My only experience with the greater Pacific Ocean area was in the service. I had no library to turn to, so I had to go to USC and UCLA for my materials and had to organize a course. I did get together with Glenn Dunkey and Rydell at Oxy and discuss with them what they had done. And then the following semester, their text came out, and we had a good enrollment. I think we had, I look upon it, it was a good course from the point of view of not only history, but humanities and social sciences.
In other words, Peterson designed all of the curriculum.
He pretty much took what had happened. He took the curriculum that had been designed at LA State, where he had first been president, took that curriculum and carried it right down here. So therefore, these are the courses I want you to teach. Recent U.S., history of the Pacific Ocean area, California history, and here I was one from the Middle West, but I had offered Latin America as one of my fields. I did know a little about the Spanish penetration of the Southwest and all. And the fourth course was medieval history. Oh, excuse me, that was the next semester. Crime and delinquency. Because he said I would have to cross sociology and history. So you can well imagine the amount of preparation that was involved. But
when you arrived when? In the beginning of September?
Yes, I came in, and classes started about the 2nd or 3rd of October. And I was told what my schedule was and had to be ready within a month with 4 separate preparations. All of our classes in that first semester were offered in the morning and everything was over at noon.
What was that?
I don't know exactly whether that was the strategy behind it, but with few students, because we only had about 169 students, and I think understanding, and I would attribute it to that, that Peterson understood that there would be a lot of time we would have to spend in preparation and also some committees, so he wasn't a great believer in committees, that we'd need large blocks of time in which to get the work done. And I had a little office in one of the, I had a kitchen which had been converted into a little office, and one of the professors was gone, he passed away many years ago, but I remember his remark to me was this. I carried a lunch and I stayed there till at least 5:30, 6 o'clock, just working, and then took my work home with me. His remark was, apparently the University of Illinois didn't prepare you too well that you have to work this hard. And I turned to him and called him by name and said, well, he happened to be in an area where the preparation was not what mine was, and I will not designate what the area was. But it didn't have much content to it, so one could guess. And I said, well, I said, if you were in an area that had the content that I had to cover, you'd understand what I'm paid with. And I, during that first year, the first couple of years, I don't think I ever had more than 5 or 6 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. Because it was just, I was reading, reading, reading. And then getting into sociology, which I had only offered as a minor at the master's level. And then remember, during that period of time, I'd been 4 years in the service, come back to the university, and just did my research for the thesis. Then had taught 2 years. I'd been away from sociology from 1941 to 1949, 8 years. I did, I guess, what a drowning man would do. You know, you're looking for anything. I wrote back to a fine friend of mine at Iowa, who taught in the same division of social sciences, and a good sociologist, and said to him, Lewis, send me everything you've got, all of your syllabi, everything, and I'll pay the postage, because I desperately need help here. And we kept on a very lively correspondence, and I offered a course, and I really enjoyed it.
Now, was there anyone else in social science?
No. We had one man, excuse me, who was in business, who taught government, because government was required for a credential. And most of our students were essentially people seeking credentials. And they had to have a course in U.S. government. So one man, who's present, still on the faculty, and he's the same age as I, taught a course in American government, and one man who was in education taught a course in American government. But otherwise, I was the only one in the social science area that first year.
Now, the comment that the other faculty member had made to you about preparation, does that indicate some tensions that there were between the faculties, or was that, between the faculty members, or was that sort of an unusual?
I don't think it reflected tension at all. I think, to me, it reflected something else. He was a man a good 12 to 15 years older than I was, a man who was, quote, an operator. He was known to simply, as students told me, his classes never had any content to them. They were fun and games. Mm-hmm. And most of us, he had held a position as a commissioned officer in the armed services during the war, and he learned some of the Washington bureaucracy and played the same game. He was a mistake, really. He got me, I won't say, but anyway.
Well, what size were your classes?
My classes were relatively large. I had my grade books from the first year I came here. They're in the other office. But I had, most of my classes ran, the smallest was 30. And they ran as high, the course that I had in crime and delinquency had 45 people. So my classes were not small, when you consider that we had a very small enrollment. There wasn't that much to offer students. And many of them taking, for example, U.S. history, were doing so because of the requirement for the credential. Many of them wanted to finish a history major or a social science major, which was then offered. And so I got that kind of a person in class. And as I mentioned in our earlier conversations, many of these were students who years earlier had been in college. Women, some women whose families were now grown, they were re-entering education. And some of whom were, for example, one woman was the wife of a very prominent judge in Long Beach. This was Ethel Keeler, whom I still see every once in a while. A woman who simply wanted to complete an education. She never had a family. It had not been convenient for her to go to Los Angeles. Fascinating people. And what I say, you know, the re-entry of women into education isn't new to me at all. Because those first years mostly were older women coming back to get an education, to get a degree. Some not intending to do anything with it. But it was a satisfaction of continuing to learn. And many of my students were that type.
And And then a lot of GIs.
A lot of GIs. And yes, they constituted a big percentage of our enrollment. But it'd be amazing if I went back and looked at the women that were in their 40s and 50s.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
It gives me some ideas in terms of that we're covering the women in the 40s
yes.
in my class.
Mm-hmm. And this is the late 1940s that they were doing this.
Do you think because you were, you said it was just yourself and one other person who was your age.
Yes.
Was there a problem, and were they paternalistic towards you, the other faculty? Was there a problem?
No, I never felt that. The only paternalism I felt was from the president. Because he had a son the same age as I was. And it was, the way he always greeted me was, hello, young fella. And there I felt I was never accepted fully as a faculty member. Because of my age,
mm-hmm.
I felt the others had something over me because they were as old or not quite as old because he was in his later 50s or middle 50s, whereas they were in their 40s. One man, Dr. Christensen, was 50 or 51 years of age, who was in the School of Education. And I found that there was a relationship with those faculty that was far different than the relationship with me. I do not mean to say he spoke down to me, but he never asked me, and this hurt many times, for my opinion or my ideas, as if, well, you know, you're a young guy yet.
Mm-hmm.
And to use his expression, as he often did, these younger people are still wet behind the ears. And I noted that especially when he was going to hire a second historian. I was not consulted, though I went to him and said, would you please hire someone who is outside of U.S. history as his or her main area of specialization. And he hired a man whose area was very close to my area of specialty. And when he arrived, he was disappointed, and we had to divide it between ourselves, what was left of the smorgasbord. But he was very kind. It was Hal Malam. And he said to me, Irv, you were here first. My area is very close to yours, where I've done my research. But he said, I want you to have the first choice. Now let's sort of sit down and divide the world between us. And that's what we did. We divide the world between us as to what we would be teaching, whether it be in English history or modern European or ancient medieval, in the U.S., we divided it up into periods. So he was very kind in that way. But the president would not give me the opportunity, even in the years that followed, any of us were not permitted to look at papers of applicants that were candidates for positions. And as a result, our department was out of balance within the first 4 years. We had two U.S. historians and two historians in English history.
But that was that was one of the problems eventually,
yes.
The style of thinking.
Yes.
Was there any participation or forum for exchange in terms of the administration of the school in the very beginning?
No, very, very little. There were no committees. Most communications came by way of memoranda, which kind of remind me of what I got while I was in the Army. I almost saw for a while a kind of a system that was very much geared to what would happen in Washington or what happened in the military, with which I was intimately acquainted after 4 years of being partially an administrative officer in the armed services. And that floored me, really, because I felt that I wasn't equal. I had that idea of equality, that I was as well-trained as they. Perhaps I didn't have as much, and I know I didn't have the experience, but at least I had the training, and that I felt the loss of consultation to be very disappointing. One of the academic deans, Dr. Brown, tried to institute this, but he was fired within a couple of years.
Now, was it discussed among the faculty, the other faculty here in the department?
Yes, and those faculty were fired. I do not know to this day, perhaps, why I was not, though I think those faculty members who were literally fired and had no recourse to any kind of grievance procedure.
This was very early?
Yes, this was 1952, which would be the time you'd be coming up for tenure consideration. were basically fired on the, as I understand it, you realize I don't have the documentation, but it seemed as if things were found out about them in their private lives, which were unacceptable to the administration. And it all seemed to be, quote, sex-related. That seemed to be the focus. And whether that was true or not, I don't know, but two of the faculty members who were fired were very much respected by students, and both outstanding teachers, scholars, to use the wording of President Horne, they were good teacher scholars, one with a PhD from Yale in psychology, and one with a PhD in English from the University of Wisconsin. The one in psychology, a man, the one in English, a woman, who could make Shakespeare live for male students. You know, they loved it. They felt, you know, very keenly and tried to fight, but there was no way to fight. There was, I was even planning to leave, but that's another story which perhaps we come into later. I started to look around for new positions by 1952.
Now, up until from 49 to 52, things had gone along pretty much the way that they had the first semester.
Pretty much, yes. In other words, it in those first 3 years, I wasn't able to evaluate too well because I simply said, I know we're in a growth situation. Most of Peterson's time was spent really with looking at construction. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a piece of land that the city of Long Beach has given to the state to build a university or a college. He seemed to be more interested in the physical plant than he really was in the academic. And that bothered many of us. And that bothered this one dean of whom I spoke and who eventually really was fired. I felt what was missing was what I had experienced in Iowa, was faculty meetings where we had the opportunity to exchange ideas. We could get into good arguments, and that's healthy. Arguments that never affected personal relationships, but which were intellectual, whether it dealt with something philosophical or curriculum or anything else. That wasn't true here. We didn't have that. And yet I attributed it again. We're new, we're few. We're all so busy, and that was a big part of it. So busy, just trying to prepare for the next day, you didn't have time to, quote, get into trouble.
So it wasn't even done on an informal basis with the faculty.
Very little. No, you found that even as I think of those first years, there were few of us that could ever sit down and talk. We didn't have time. Most of them had four preparations. If you talk to any of them, I'm sure this is what we'll find out. Those first years, those that still can tell us their stories, were teaching. You never repeated a course. You didn't have a double in any semester. I kept offering new courses. In the years that I've been here, I've taught 30 different courses. And of course, most of the numerous courses, getting into that many number, were the early years. Mm-hmm. Because I had to introduce a history major. And therefore, if it was going to be a major, we had to introduce courses so students could get a decent major.
And you wouldn't want to cut off them.
And then Malin came the next year, we
and
kept offering.
1950 then?
Yes, mm-hmm. 1950.
Mm-hmm. Was he about your age?
No. No, he's already retired, and he's now about, well, he's a good 10 to 11 years older than I. So he was a man in his early 40s who came from Stevens College, which was a women's college in Missouri, considered at that time, it's now a four-year, I think, co-educational institution, but considered kind of an elitist school, kind of a finishing school for the daughters of very wealthy people. But he was a California product, PhD from Berkeley, and had grown up in Fresno, and had wanted to come back to California, and through somebody that Dr. Peterson knew, that's how he hired him.
How did you feel once he was here then in terms of the possibility of developing a relationship?
There I was very happy because you'll find that Hal Malin is a kind of a person that if you are kind and understanding of him, he's a very flexible individual. You don't cross him. If you do, you get nowhere. But he and I sat down together as if we were at a conference table and saying, okay, where are you strong? Where am I strong? So that we can introduce courses that these students can get, hopefully, in quotation marks, a decent history major. And as we did so, it was give and take. And you'd say, Irv, I feel stronger, like I'd like to teach English history. I said, okay, I'm very much interested in Latin America. I'll take the Latin American end of it. And then he'd turn around and he'd be interested in something else in U.S. history. He said, I like the colonial period as well as the period of Jefferson up through Lincoln and all. He said, but I know that that's your favorite. You take that. Let me take the colonial. I said, fine. We did similarly with all of our courses. And in all the years I worked with him and we shared offices, there was never, never an ill word between us. Never.
Did either of you, or I should say did you, and maybe you would know people too, have expectations of what would happen in terms of your own role as the department grew, which you obviously anticipated?
What we didn't know, and to which we could not get an answer, was would we ever have, quote, a department of history? And Peterson let us know that he felt departments were something to be avoided. He was going to use a divisional structure. Therefore, we'd be part of a division of social science. He had the impression, and I can understand it now. I didn't understand it as well then, but he felt departments generally became empire builders. And they tend to build themselves up beyond what probably their capabilities are, or overhire this type of thing and get too specialized. If I would describe him, he was a man who really believed in education to be general education. His common remark to me, I think, explains it. When he said, I'd like to have you see many of these students, most of these students, as not being history majors, but as someone, and this would amuse you, who perhaps would pump my gas for me at the local gas station, but could tell me a little bit about India, would know a little bit about China. And so therefore he requested, a couple years later, that we introduce a course called The World and Its People.
Like a junior high school theology.
Exactly.